The part of Blake that I want to talk about today, and I think you should probably write some of this down, because he's a very difficult person to keep track of, and he's also a person that you're going to run into eventually again. He is a man who strangely enough, if I were to explain him carefully enough to you so that you knew everything about his philosophy and his mythopoeic ability, in which he really excels in a way that nobody has done until Tolkien and the Inklings, the C.S. Lewis and that group. Up until that time, Blake was the only one who really was able to create a myth that hung together with real meaning, that had a religious background, that had a communicated kind of meaning to it that was valid. If I were to explain it to you in detail, or if you were to write a paper on him, say, I think some of you would be surprised and say, you know, wow, that isn't so far off from what a lot of people maybe think about right now. How many of you how many of you know who Nietzsche is?
No.
All right, who is he? You want to tell me?
He's a German author. Mm-hmm. And he write also Sprach der Geschichte.
Yes. What's his big thing? You know?
Mm-hmm. He's against Christianity.
Yeah, but why? Anybody know?
He thinks that we're slaves, too much slaves to Christ, and not. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what else. We're not slaves to.
No, that's true. He wrote a book called Beyond Good and Evil. Now, what do you suppose Beyond Good and Evil would be about? Beyond Good and Evil. There are, this is the thing that Nietzsche was concerned about, was the slave morality, as Tim has said, about the Christians, because he felt, and ask yourself about this, he felt that the obedience complex of Christians had really depressed them, so that they were a bunch of sort of milksops. They weren't, you know, vigorous people. And he quite appealing person to read when you're in college, unless you've already got your mindset so heavily in one direction that you can't read anything else, which I hope is not true, because I think even if you are a committed Christian, you have to be able to read some of these other things and not feel like you're afraid to read them because you're afraid you might, it might hurt my faith. You know, you got to protect it. You know, God doesn't need to be protected, so forget it. I mean, if God isn't big enough to be, you know, if you can't read other things because you're afraid that your faith is going to be damaged, your faith is a pretty weak little thing and really belongs in a box of jeweler's cotton. But Nietzsche is somebody you really ought to read, because you need him for your own muscles. You ought to really have to fight through at least one of his books. Beyond Good and Evil is, he develops the whole theory of the Superman, and it isn't the comic, but it's the whole understanding or the concept of a person who is bigger than the morality of the hoi polloi. The hoi polloi, by the way, are two Greek words. You may have thought that was just a slang expression, but it's not. It's perfectly good Greek background. Hoi polloi. And when you get farther in Greek, you'll find out what it means. But he felt that the whole common herd, so to speak, morality, was so low, and that there was very little real development or real strength in the people who in the Christian church, And of course he had a great deal to say against Jesus Christ, because he felt he was the main problem, naturally. He should be, mainly because he emphasized so much meekness and submission and surrender and so on. And the reason I'm telling you about this is because I want, when we discuss Blake right now, I want you to see how those two come into juxtaposition. It's not strange that Nietzsche's effect on Germany was strong enough to produce a kind of a backstop for a lot of Hitler's palaver about a super race, and the fact that we needed to develop a race of people who would really govern the earth and who would really be in charge. And they didn't have to be affected by the ordinary kind of morality that governs the average person, because they were going to be up in, you know, in the ruling areas of the earth, and they would be leading, particularly the Germanic peoples, to controlling the world. Nietzsche ended in an insane asylum, and his whole philosophy didn't really work out so very well for him. But there are many, many people who have been strongly affected by him, and he is one of the great philosophers, one of the great writers of the last century, and has had a great deal to do with the thinking of many people, at least in, you know, even against him, contrary to him. He does produce a definite kind of reaction, so that you have to start rethinking. Now, is this really the way? I mean, are we supposed to live such flat, stepped on kind of lives? Is that the way human beings were supposed to be? Is that what they were created for? And is Christianity a perversion of the real reason for life? Well, now just think about lowly Jesus, meek and mild, you know, like a little child, you know, that kind of picture of Christianity is a very, very general one, and we've all got it wherever we picked it up. So Nietzsche had something specific to say about that. Now Blake said very much the same thing, but not against Christianity. He identified Christianity with an entirely different approach to life. As I said yesterday, or last night when we were talking about Blake, Blake's whole thrust was in the direction of the imagination, and the fact that when man is regenerated, he lives a life not of, you know, sort of being ground down. And Blake had very much the same feeling about the way in which Christians, but he didn't believe that Christianity was this way. He believed this was the way the church had polluted and perverted Christianity. And that all this kind of all these heavy laws and strict almost bars to the personality and the way in which a person lived was exactly what Jesus did not want and what he didn't talk about. He felt actually, what you finally got was dullness. That the distinguishing feature of the average Christian, in terms of, and there it would be Christian in quotation marks, because Blake did not feel they were really Christians. He felt this was the kind of church Christianity that had been developed. The average feature of this group of people was dullness and a sort of lugubrious heaviness, kind of a sogginess. Anything but the kind of thing that you saw last night in that film. Now, if you may not have liked that film, and you didn't have to, but at least you could never call it soggy or dull. I mean, it hit you, and it was this way and that way, but you knew that whoever was involved in that, in the producing of those paintings and of those writings, was somebody that was on fire, was really aflame. Now, do you remember any Bible verse from the New Testament where Jesus talks about fire?
Did you come to bring fire in this story?
Right. I came to bring fire on the earth, and I would that it were kindled. And he said, I come to set division between a mother and a daughter and a son and a daughter-in-law against a mother-in-law and so on. I mean, that there was going to be a lot of controversy, and there was a lot of, you know, jangling, and this was not peace, perfect peace, da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, I mean, that wasn't it. I mean, when Jesus talked about what was going to happen when he got into life, it was going to be fire, and it was going to be division, and there was going to be a thrust of some kind. Now that's what you get in Blake. He fought very vigorously against any kind of passivity. That's spelled with two S's, passivity, because he felt that the bonds of sin were the bonds that chained the person to a kind of a hand-folded, well, it really doesn't concern me, rock. Because as long as I'm not doing anything, I'm not going to be doing anything wrong either. You know, I mean, how many of you have ever heard, has anybody ever said, do you remember anybody saying to you, hey, you be nice and quiet for a while. Couldn't you be good and quiet? I mean, do you remember that when you were little? Being told to be good and quiet? I mean, goodness and quietness. Goodness and stillness. Goodness and don't do anything. I mean, you know, don't get into any trouble. I mean, those two things are so identified in our psychology, we can't get loose from them. That goodness has nothing to do somehow with being active. You know, the quieter you are, the gooder you are. That's really true, you know. That's what all mothers think. And I'm a mother, and I know a lot more peaceful. You get a lot more done if you know that everybody's being good and quiet. But Blake's approach all the way through in his understanding of Christianity, and he considered himself a biblical Christian, was that activity was the key to Christianity. Not surrender, not a folded hand kind of a withdrawal. It was an outward thing in which the imagination, as I said last night, was the big symbol, the big word. Now, in order to be a part of this kind of religion or this kind of life, it required a great deal of vigor and energy. You don't get into this kind of a stream without learning to swim with, you know, and really pounding. I mean, it's not just kind of something you can sleep into. And that's why he was so violent in the way in which he talked about it. Because he felt, and it was true and it still is true, that a great deal of the general atmosphere that prevails when you talk about anything that has to do with Jesus Christ, it is kind of a subdued thing. be very lusty and vigorous, and people can play a lot of guitars and can bang drums, and you know, there can be a lot of generated noise. But there's so often is the feeling that, but you know, this is our joy, but we're not really that kind of people. We're really good and quiet inside because we're surrendered to Jesus Christ. And that surrender is always implies a laying down of our weapons. Well, in terms of the way in which Blake interpreted this, he felt that when people talk that way, they laid down all their energies. They felt that the energies of life were wrong. That the fact that you had a sex life was wrong. The fact that you had a desire to communicate with other people, something that was part of you, that was wrong. People thought that was, you know, you should always say things just the way so nobody would be bothered by what you say. There shouldn't be any communication that wasn't just in, you know, in the grooves that everybody would feel at home with. Blake felt that the importance of the regenerating experience, which you saw last night, when you saw those pictures of those people falling down, you know, into the abyss, and they were twisting and turning, and they looked, you know, really in great pain and suffering, and then the narrator says, but out of that, people came out of that, and they came into, very often, into a new life, because the suffering that they went through actually was just part of the casting off of the old and moving into the new. Now, this is what that picture was last night, because Blake felt that every single time that a person comes before God and loses himself and comes into this new kind of life, which he calls the imagination, which is the regenerated life, they go through a judgment day, a literal judgment day, and their experience is very much that of a soul in torment, which he pictured last night. Now, how many of you have read the Narnia books? Do you remember when what's his name lost his dragon skin?
Eustace.
It was a pleasant experience. It was really awful. It was a horrible thing. You know, it hurt so, and he didn't want it. He said, no, I didn't want to have it happen. Then finally he had to have it happen, and Aslan had to scrape him with his claws to get that nasty scale off, and it hurt, and the claw marks were there. I mean, that it's the same kind of picture. Now Lewis has developed a myth too. You know, Aslan is that's a myth. That whole story, just like Blake has done, only we're not going into his myths because they're too difficult and too long. But I'm giving you what he was trying to teach and what he was trying to talk about. The experience of going from a life of selfhood into a life of the imagination is a torturous kind of thing. Now, this is true for anyone who is, you know, when you move from unconscious life into conscious life. I mean, when you move from being just a you know, kind of a vegetable or an animal into a conscious human being who knows that decisions have to be made and that you're responsible for decisions, and that life has a real value to you because you move into it, and you move into it with your eyes open, your ears open, and you know you're there all the way. This is a really difficult experience, no matter how it happens. But when you understand it as before God, it's much more acute. It's a radical thing, and Blake was very specific in the way in which he illustrated it, as you saw last night, but he also was very, very, he talked about it all the time throughout his, throughout the different things that he wrote. He felt that the, and this is why I mentioned this about paying, about your having to pay attention to things, the importance of the mind was tremendous to Blake. Now this was not the ratio. It isn't just a rational kind of thing. It's not just, you know, that the mind is so great and therefore the body is nothing. But he realized that your the information that you get and that you collect and that you make use of comes through your mind. That's what sorts out what happens to your senses. And he said what was important was that the senses, the things that happen to your senses have to go through your mind in order for the imagination to make use of them. In other words, you can't just be a sense person. You can't just feel what a beautiful day it is, look at a beautiful bird, you know, see a great person, or, you know, I mean, those things, that's not enough. You have to be able to project into that all the possibilities that are there. Now, that requires mental energy. And a lot of you have never used mental energy, I'm sure. And it's not one of these, it's not Christian Science or Zen or that kind of stuff. It's simply being able to use the faculties of your brains so that you actually are looking at something and trying to see it and in all of its fullness. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody's going to look at everything the same way. I hope not, because the great thing about it is everybody is different, and you all bring your own particular bag of experiences to every experience you have. But you can just be an old slob the rest of your lives, Blake felt, if you're going to be passive and just let things happen. And, you know, you can probably be relatively happy. Cows are, you know. But I mean, you aren't alive. And this is what Blake was beating the drum for and pounding violently whenever he wrote and whenever he talked and whenever he painted. He was pushing these things. And of course it was exactly the opposite of what the church had proclaimed, because the church had been very authoritarian and always wanted everybody to kind of, as I say, be good and quiet, and they were not encouraging imagination. How many times has the church really given shelter to any kind of a new painter? I mean, they'll take the old painters, but you take a new one. They'll have nothing to do with it, or a new poet, or any kind of a new artist. You say something new, and the church says, oh, no, that isn't the way it was done last year, or when my fathers, you know, when we were brought up. That isn't the way we had the catechism. And that's what counts. Well, see, Blake felt that this is because the church had completely misunderstood that Jesus Christ came to bring a new thing. And he's always bringing a new thing. He's not just bringing a new thing once, but he's continually bringing new things every time he hits somebody. And he as he says in one little place, he says, humility is only doubt. And does the sun and moon blot it out? Well, you know the other one, if the sun and moon should doubt, they'd immediately go out. Now, the important thing about this is that Blake was also talking very strongly about risk. That the imagination, the life of the imagination, the life of the regenerated person involves risk. The name that he gave to the unregenerate person, the person who has not been born again, he called a person who is living in selfhood. selfhood. Now, it's just the way it sounds, but written with a capital S. S-E-L-F-H-O-O-D. That's a very important term with Blake, because he continually refers to selfhood as the kind of animal existence that people have when they just go rolling along, taking care of themselves, taking care of what their needs are. Now, do you criticize a dog because he runs and takes care of his, you know, eats as fast as he can and goes and lies down when he feels like it and you know, doesn't worry about going to private bathrooms and stuff like that? You know, nobody criticizes an animal. Boy, it really is snowing. He talked about regeneration as being in the same way that we talk about it too, as regenerated. You know, that people were born into a fallen world. He's very strongly in the fact that the world as such was a fallen world, and there was a sin, there was a fall, and that because of that fall, anybody who is going to move out of that fallen world has to be reborn, has to be regenerated, because otherwise they will live like the animals live, in simply in their selfhood, in a perfectly instinctive kind of selfish development, in which you just take care of yourself. It's a perfect, obvious thing to do. But it is living as a fallen person, as an unregenerate person, as an animal or as a vegetable, which is, we call people vegetative existences or animal existences. The you remember the picture of the sunflower last night?
Mm-hmm.
Remember that horrible ending? The end of it, mm-hmm, is just this huge, you know, just almost like a ghoulish kind of person, the sunflower. The sunflower, that particular little poem, is the story of the sunflower as it just longs to get to the sun. But it's not able to because its roots are in the earth and it can't get loose. It's not reborn. It's a vegetable. It's part of the ground. And it can't get out. And it's a symbol of the way in which a person is who is not living, who has not moved into the second life, into the new life. He's not living the life of the imagination. He's simply bound by the fallen world to which he was born. Now this is what Blake understood this very clearly, and that's what called himself a biblical Christian. The way he read the Bible is another thing. There were a lot of really rare interpretations that he had, which I will not indulge in at this moment, but they really are funny. I'm trying to pick up some of the things that are very positive and have a lot to do it could have been tremendous correctives. Carol was saying this morning when he woke up, he said, you know, I'm just thinking how, what a difference it would have made in England if somebody had listened to Blake before that whole Victorian prudery set in. Because prudery and prurience, do you know what prurience is?
Mm-mm. How do you spell it?
Well, you know what prudery is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Prudery is people say, oh, no, they shouldn't wear bikinis. Well, you know, I used to say that. I sometimes still do when I don't like the way they look. But anyway, you know, there are a lot of prudishnesses about all of us. I mean, some of us are older, so we have a lot more. But the Victorian period, do you know anything about the Victorian period?
What was that other word besides prudery?
Well, I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. Do you know about the...
Is that... I'm reading a book right now, The Clergyman's Daughter by Orwell. Is that from that era? Anglican church.
Well, yeah, he talks about, but it doesn't have to be Anglican, although that is the period in that the Anglican church was a strong church in England at the time, and still is. But the Victorian period, you know anything about the Victorian period?
What was that other word besides prudery?
Oh, I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. Do you know about the...
Is that, I'm reading a book right now, The Clergyman's Daughter by Orwell. Is that from that era? Anglican church.
Well, yeah, he talks about, but it doesn't have to be Anglican, although that is the
period, and the Anglican Church was the strong church in England at the time.
But the Victorian period, you know anything about the Victorian period?
What was that other word besides prudery?
Well, I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. You know about the...
Is that, I'm reading a book right now, The Clergyman's Daughter by Earl of Bath from that era? Anglican church.
Well, yeah, he talked about the, but it doesn't have to be Anglican, although that is the period in that the Anglican church was the strong church in England at the time, and still is. But the Victorian period was big on prudery. That is, it was big on external morality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and do you remember last night when Blake talked so much about secrecy in human dress?
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? In a woman's dress or in human dress?
Mm-hmm.
And his people are all as is.
Yeah.
And you didn't feel any kind of a feeling of, you know, you don't have any feeling like that at all. I don't think. I'm sure some people who were here did, but not in here, but I mean, who looked at it did, but I mean, that's not the way you feel about it. It just looked right the way they should be. And you see, the Victorian period, you know, that was when there were all the bustles and all the stuff. And when a woman was pregnant, she stayed inside with a broken ankle for like 8 or 9 months, a long time. You know, they were never around, never around when they had, well, you know, you just couldn't be, because after all, the style was, and you had everything had to be a certain way. They didn't have any other way to live. But that was because their whole approach was covered up everything as much as possible. Then what happened? Who, do you remember that, you know the figure that comes back quite often in quite a few of those frames in the movie last night? Remember the harlot? When he talked about the London street and the sad places. Remember that she's a whore, a person who's a prostitute. Did you ask me what she was?
I said, what was the harlot?
That was the one where he talked about the harlot's face and how sad it is that there she is. And you see these women's faces and they just look absolutely, and she's got her foot on a baby, you know, because she can't.
Talked about young harlots, didn't it, the whole time?
He talked about young harlots most of the time, because I suppose the old ones weren't that good to paint. I mean, they were really bad looking, really miserable. You felt a real suffering all the way through those paintings. And Blake felt he was so miserable, because he felt that Victorian England, and we still do, you know, we're not condoning prostitution. We're not encouraging it. But the Victorian England just said, "Oh, harlot." Well, who else said the same thing? Remember the incident with Jesus?
Yeah. Oh,
the Pharisee. Remember with a woman taken in adultery? What did he say? Yeah, and then, you know, and they all left. And Leo Bustin, one of his favorites, one person cast a stone and Leo Bustin said, "Mother, sometimes you get me." Well, now, you know, I'm going to tell you something. And first I'm going to tell you something. I really meant to told you that story because I want to tell you something else about in connection with Blake's understanding, and I'm going to ask you to think about it. Purity. What Kathy just asked me about is spelled P-R-U-R-I-E-N-T-E. Now that is a kind of a delight. P-R-U-R-I-E-N-T-E. Prurient. And that's kind of just getting a lot of enjoyment about a lot of just general anything that's a little nasty. Or a big nasty, either one. But I mean something that you really, you know, and because, and you enjoy it because it's forbidden.
So guys tell dirty stories, you know, back in one corner, and girls tell kind of in another corner, and you know, that's just one little angle of it. And then, you know, a lot of these porno things come out of that. It's just kind of a mouth, lip licking, tongue licking kind of a thing of enjoying things that are really, you know, that you purposely make bad so that they become more interesting. Now, this is what Blake was really opposed to. He said sex and the human body, the relationship of the sexes, these were given at creation as gifts. They were not meant to be made into come-ons and pornographical kinds of things, which is what happened in the Victorian age and certainly has gone on ever since, and a long time before that. He was very concerned that if we only understood that there was openness here, we wouldn't have this kind of thing developing. Because when you put all these big, you know, thou shalt not in front of people, that then of course they're going to get all the more excited, and then they're going to think, ha ha, we're fooling God, we're going to have a little fun on our own, and have a lot more fun because he said we shouldn't. And Blake said, this is wrong. This is an interpretation of God that the church in its perversion has developed, that God isn't that way, and that Jesus Christ isn't that way. He never wanted people to be that kind of shameful, shamefaced people. He wanted them to be his sons and daughters and to be open and before him in lives of the imagination. Now, when I tell you these things, I have to, as I did last night, tell them, well, no, don't you say that, because, you know, true, you should have had a lot more exposure than he did, because you don't have to protect people from it. But it is true that his interpretations are theologically really way off the beam. Some of them are just, they blow your mind because they're so crazy. But in a lot of the things, he's dead center, because he really does get at the fact that Jesus, when you read him, would try to sort of clear off some of the heavy, heavy tradition that we're so enveloped in. And when you read the Bible, try to read it, you know, with some kind of a fresh eye, you say, oh, is that really so? You know, did he really say that? Because it is very much a lot of the kind of thing that Blake was getting at. Now, I wanted to just mention a couple more things, and then I want to bring out in connection with this, I'm going to skip over one section and talk about his relations, understanding of the female principle, and why I mentioned that what sort of bothered me about that joke of Leo's. And Leo I love dearly, and you know, he's, I don't know, a more dedicated Christian or a more honest Christian than Leo Bustad is. And yet, I mean, when he told that story, I thought, you know, it's bad taste. And yet, I thought about it today, and I was reading
what
I just said about that. See, because Mary was a virgin, so she could see through the stone at the woman, because she was the only one that really, from the point of view of the Catholics, she didn't have any sin. See?
I thought you
were saying
that about his mother.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. No, 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 no. No, Jesus said, sometimes you really get me. No, it was because Mary threw the stone. You see, because she was a virgin and she had never caught in adultery. I wanted to just bring up one more thing in connection with Blake's understanding of this whole life of the imagination, of the regeneration from out of selfhood into a life of the imagination, which did involve, by the way, relationships with your brother. I mean, you were responsible for your neighbor then. You saw people because you saw people with the imagination. You see, you no longer saw them in terms of exploitation. As I said last night, you don't live in the world to make the most of it, but you live in it to make the best of it. It's just two different things. They're superlatives, both of them, but they're entirely different when you relate and you know, everybody says, you know, now make the most of your opportunities. Make the most of your time at home village. Make the most of it. Make the most of it. Well, and Blake said, make the best of it. Now that may not be the most of it. In connection with this, his whole understanding of good and evil then was involved with energy, action, and this whole life imagination as a thrust of living. It was not withdrawal from life, it was into life. And it was understanding, you know, going beyond just the scope of where you happen to be right now, that you live here, but you can live in all the worlds of all the continents of the world, because your imagination could span the earth. And you could, as I said last night about Ernie, and see a world in a bird, a world of delight when you looked at a bird. Now, you know, and we don't all see that, but some of you see something, you look at a stone and you can see that. Or some people can see it looking at something else. But Blake said, when you begin to let your imagination move, then this is what God gives you. You see?
Mm-hmm. When you just say imagination, couldn't you just be saying, let a regenerated person go that
yes,
far?
Yes, but you see, I have to use imagination because that's the word Blake uses, just like he uses selfhood, and he uses imagination because Kathy, one thing very important, I think, for all of us as who are traditionally within the church to some extent, either one way or another, it's very, very good for you to use other terms for the typical Christian terms. See, this is where C.S. Lewis and the Inklings did such a great service to the Christian witness, because they used other names for things, and as a result, a lot of people got baited on stuff that they didn't know they were going to get. They got caught. Mm-hmm. And it's also good for you in terms of your own thinking, because you start, you know, when you start thinking about yourself in another way than just the usual terms, I'm saved, or I'm a Christian, or I have a personal savior, or however you want to say it, you know, all these different things that we've used for so long. It's a good thing to use a different word, because, you know, your mind begins to have to start dealing with another set of ideas. And this is where the imagination begins to really hold on. That's why imagination is a good word. I don't say that you should use it, you know, in general. I'm sure you don't need to write home to your parents and talk about your regenerated imagination. but the figure that you're you're really not. But then you can say, well, of course she's less now, that lady, so it's all right. but what I mean is that I think that's just good for you to at least I find it's good for me to think in terms of other things than the ones I've always used. Because it's like a breath of air. It just sort of makes you, your muscles sort of cinch up like that, and you have to change some of your ways of thinking and doing. And that's why I think it's good to use it. He, interestingly, when he talked about the devil, he was a very, very, very real thing to William Blake. Oh, he really was. And he said, the problem, the devil is diabolos. Now, I don't know how many of you had Latin, but diabolos, D-I-A-B-O-L-O-S, is the same word as in Greek. you throw the stone at somebody. You're throwing something at somebody all the time. And that's what Satan does, or what the devil does. He's the accuser. Now, both Paul and Martin Luther felt that this was the right name for Satan, always. He is the accuser. He's always trying to make you feel miserable. And Blake felt that the thing that Satan wants you to do is to feel like, oh, I'm not to do this. It's too much work. I can't live that kind of life. Anyway, I'm not really forgiven. Well, now, you know, that's pretty traditional. That's really what the scripture says, that Satan always wants to put you in the feeling that, you know, Jesus Christ hasn't really done the thing for you. If you may have done it for Peter and Paul, but he hasn't done it for you. Blake says that this is the Satan that we have to fight against. And we really got to be aware of the fact that he's with somebody to fight with. And when Paul talks about struggling with principalities and powers, and when he talks about having this battle all the time in his person, he really means that there is a battle going on. And it's not just something that was over and done with, but that you've always got Satan after you, trying to make you feel like, you know, you can't make it. Why don't you quit now? You can't make it. And so then as a result, you relapse into despair, which is the worst thing that can happen to anybody. And the way Blake describes it is really neat. He says, you get, what comes over you is a kind of imaginative idleness. It just floods you, and you just feel like, oh, well, I'm just not. It's maybe for other people, but it's not for me. And that particular experience of the person is known, and I want you to write these words down because they're words that you're going to run into the rest of your life if you go to college or you do any reading. There are these words all mean somewhat the same thing. The word that was used in the Middle Ages and was part of the, came from the Greek heritage, but it's, this is the Latin word for it, is acidia. A-C-C-I-D-I-A. Now that means a lack of purpose, a kind of a just, almost a, you know, a despair of life almost, but not enough to commit suicide, but just a kind of a feeling of...
No direction.
Yeah, no direction, and a feeling like you're not worth anything. See, the direction isn't even your direction, but that the lack of direction is because there's something wrong with you. You see? You're lacking something. And so you can't really fight it. And that's why he called it this idleness that just spreads over you, and you have the feeling that it's just sort of like a lot of tentacles that are just kind of finally covering you up, and you aren't going to be able to move finally because you can't even get your arms out. The word in the Elizabethan period was melancholy. Now you run into in Elizabethan writing, you run into a lot of odes on melancholy. Milton, of course, in the just right after Elizabethan period, you know that he has one, but melancholy is almost like it's a person. It's almost like a demon or something. And then of course some people really enjoy it. You know, they enjoy ill health, they also enjoy being melancholy. But when it's really serious, melancholy is a horrible thing. And it really leads to despair. Another word that's used is the French word ennui. E-N-N-U-I, which I'm sure you've seen you see that in writing. E-N-N-U-I, ennui. And that's boredom. Boredom. And lack of purpose, lack of direction, and a feeling of just, you know, as I say, just almost like, yeah, there's just nothing there. All these different kinds of of words. All these words express the same thing, but you see they're present in all sorts of different cultures and places. They're every place where life has had any active meaning, you have this kind of thing happening. And Blake understood that this was one of Satan's best little deals. You know, he could really get you if he could really clobber you in a very quiet way with this sort of an idleness of the imagination, so that you no longer felt that you really were going to struggle and fight, and you know, with your brain to really go ahead and keep moving. And so he knew very definitely that Satan was an enemy, and that he recognized the effects of that kind of attack that Satan had. We always think about Satan as being somebody that's going to lead us into some really wild temptation. Might also be kind of fun, but you know, this one is not that. And that's what's really good about it, is that you realize the real degradation of what Satan leads you into is this kind of despair, which cripples you completely. And Blake felt that the reason that we get into this is because we don't believe that our sins are really forgiven and that they're forgotten, so that we can actually live what Jesus called the abundant life. See, these things do fit finally when you get it all together. They make sense. You know, they do make sense. But as I say, I'm leaving out some very big hunks of things that I... You can run into them yourselves if you want to go into Blake very seriously. You can study him yourself. But I'm trying to give you the things that actually I think are valuable and helpful. I mean, that actually you can learn from Blake something very, very good. There are other things that he said that are involved in a lot of his visions that are much more complicated and are, as I say, off here and off there, and I don't think they have to be, I don't think they have to deal with it. But I did want to talk to you a little bit about, before you have to go down, and I do want you to have a few minutes before you have to go to Rhetoric, because you need some fresh air. Do you want that window open?
No.
Are you all right? Well, of course, you don't have your shoes on. You can't come. But I was worried about the rest of the people. If you get too hot, there is a window in there that can be open. Freda was asking last night what she felt. She was really kind of concerned about the fact that Blake was kind of hard on women. She felt like, you know, she wondered, what do you really, you know, what was his position on women? And so I thought I should give you a little bit on his understanding of the female principle, because it's very important, and it is not far off. And I'm a woman. I don't like to have women put down, but I think that you have to remember that when you talk and discuss female principle, for heaven's sake, you who are girls, don't consider this an attack on you. I mean, when you talk about a female principle and a masculine principle, these are principles in the makeup of people, and also for many philosophers, it's part of the makeup of certain philosophies. And Blake understood it this way. And when you talk about when somebody talks about the female principle, don't feel like you have to feel, you know, protective about yourself and Just remember that nobody's hitting at you personally, unless the shoe fits. And there, believe me, there are plenty of places where this shoe fits. I'll get to it real fast. The female principle in Blake was, to him, a real problem for the development of the imagination. He felt that, for one thing, the the whole mother, what he called the soft family love, and then you can write that down and put it in quotation marks with a capital F on family. Soft family, and then a hyphen, love. Soft family love. He felt that that was a real hampering and a hindrance to the development of the imagination. Now, think about that. And you don't have to think about your mother, but just think about your home, generally. You may have had a very wonderful home, or you may have had a bad one. I mean, I don't know. But if you're going to grow, can you stay within that home, no matter how beautiful and good and Christian and loving and affirmative it is?
Let me stay in the home.
Physically and mentally, both. I'm glad you mentioned that. Both. Because some people can be a long ways away from home, but they're still there.
Yeah.
Now, what did Jesus say about that? Who did he say we should hate?
Mother and father.
Yeah. You have to hate your father and mother. Now, what about this commandment? Honor thy father and thy mother. Remember when Jesus got caught in that one? Because he said, you're eating stuff that is the korban, you know, the thing that was supposed to be given as a sacrifice. Jesus was very, very clear on the fact that the dead have to bury their dead. You can't go and take care of your parents, even if you've got a bride, you know. Okay, if you're going to follow me, you're going to have to cut those strings, and that hurts. Does that mean you're never going to have to do with your families anymore? Does that mean, you know, okay, you know, too bad, but I'm regenerate now, and there's going to be no more communication. You know that, yeah. No, that's not what he's getting at. What he's getting at is a deep experience psychologically and spiritually, emotionally, all the way through your person, of being able to say no to your family. Not orally, not physically. Although sometimes you have to. I mean, there's times when I had to say no to my father, when he said one thing to me, and I said no when I decided to marry Carol. And that was it was a real break with my parents, because they thought Carol was too much of a fanatic and a radical. And my father was a bishop. But I love them, and we had wonderful relationships afterwards, but at that time, there was no way that I could have both and actually, although, I married Carol because I loved him, but still, the thing is, I also had to say no to my parents, also because to me, they stood in the way of something that was also what I felt was part of what God had done, too, for me. Now that's something that can happen to you. Doesn't have to happen in terms of a relationship like that, I hope, but still it might. But it's something that happens and doesn't always happen in one great fell swoop. Okay, I've cut the strings of my umbilical cord with my mother and my father, and I'm out on my own. That isn't always true. Sometimes it's a slow process. Sometimes you cut off at one time, and then you come back a little bit, and then you cut off a little more, and then you sort of, it's sometimes going back and forth, but there has to be, sometimes when you really are, I'm on my own feet, you know, I'm living my life, and I'm responsible. The terrible, terrible desire to creep back to the womb, which is one of the big psychological you know, images, has been a problem for many, many people. And it cuts a lot of people off of their own growth because they don't dare to be themselves. They feel like they've got to be something that fits into what their mother or father thinks they should be.